Welcome to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast.
So, welcome to our Stories That Matter, Hawkwood's podcast series, which invites changemakers, thinkers, artists, and innovators to discuss the stories that have influenced them, their visions for the future, and the actions they are taking to change the world. Today, we are talking to two exceptional artistic collaborators, who are two of the 150 artists we welcome every year to Hawkwood to create new work. Missy Mazzoli, Grammy-nominated composer, was recently deemed one of the most consistently inventive, surprising composers now working in New York. And we have Royce Vavrek, who is Canada-born, Brooklyn-based librettist and lyricist, who has been called a metastasio of the downtown opera scene. I love these comments. So welcome, Missy and Royce. Welcome to Hawkwood. So you have been here nearly 5 days, collaborating in Studio 2, buried away in there, working on a new project. But I'd love to find out a little bit about your journey here and what's brought you here today. Mm-hmm. So Missy, can you share your story of how you got started as a composer?
Sure. So I started playing piano when I was 7, like a lot of other kids, but I became obsessed with it. And I became obsessed with not only playing, but the stories of the composers and the stories that they were telling through their work. And I was just completely, it found a way to understand the world. Music was the lens through which I started to understand the world. And it was my window into so many different other art forms. So it was my window into poetry and philosophy and theater and painting. And even at a young age, I thought this is a field that will allow me to do a lot of different things. So I decided at that point that I was going to be a composer, and I just have pursued it ever since then. That was 35 years ago.
Fantastic. Yeah.
And studied it through college, and then moved to New York and started making work for orchestras and soloists and chamber ensembles. And then about 10 years ago, premiered our first opera. I can mm-hmm. gesture to my collaborator, Royce. And opera really became a really big part of my life and my creative output. And so we wrote our first opera that premiered 11 years ago, actually. And we're here at Hawkwood writing our sixth opera together.
That's wonderful.
It's been an amazing journey from playing piano to writing six operas now.
Yeah. And when you were younger, did you just spend your whole time buried in the music room at school? Or how did it work? How did it feel when you discovered this musical world? Was it, how did you work with other kids at school, mm-hmm. or was it just a real focus for you?
Well, I mean, I was a pianist and a composer, which is a very solitary way to make music often. I was not playing in orchestra. I was playing percussion in band because we didn't have a percussionist. And I was playing the tuba parts in band on a keyboard because we didn't have a tuba player. Anyway, so other than that, I was really working on music alone, playing piano alone, writing music alone. And I think that's another reason why I love the collaborative nature of opera, is that you're working with hundreds of other people to make a show happen.
Yeah, and it brings together all the art forms, doesn't it, really? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Mm-hmm. And Royce, you're here on the sofa in the Hawkwood Library here now.
This beautiful green sofa, yes.
Lovely green sofa. And tell me a little bit about your story. How did you get into being a librettist?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm in northern Alberta, Canada, and I was very lucky to have two parents who really valued music. Although, my dad was a grain farmer, mm-hmm. And my mom was a nurse, but for some reason, music had just entered their bones, and it was very important that all of their kids had piano at 5, and then I found singing lessons at the age of about 9. And so music was such a huge, huge thing in my household. And my dad would sit at the piano and play his 5 songs by ear, pretty much every day. And so it was a very warm musical home. And they invested a lot of time and money into my musical education. And then in high school, I found, a teacher who really, took me under her wing and said that she was a social studies teacher. And said that she was teaching drama, and I could have the entire budget of the drama class, which was about $300 Canadian dollars.
That's wonderful.
To write plays and do them. And so we had black boxes, and I spent most of the money on costumes, I believe. Mm-hmm. And she entered us into the one-act play festivals around our province. And I was just given this unbelievable agency to tell my stories, and also to tell them in a way that was as theatrically vivid without having all the trappings that money can offer in scenography and that sort of thing. So I really credit Paulette Long for being an educator that just completely changed my life. And then a singing teacher, Ellen Otterson, who passed during COVID, but she was so extraordinary in her, in the way that she inspired me to go out and find my own musical theater songs and things like that. And she knew that I was getting a little bit complacent in piano, even though she wasn't teaching me piano. She was like, oh, here's some really challenging piano music that you should go try. And she just tried to sort of get my imagination. And to get me working hard and to know that if I really strived for an exceptional standard in my art making, that would sort of push me into a professional career. And so, yeah, I was very, very lucky to have these two women and then my parents, who encouraged me and gave me a lot of room to sort of find myself. And then I went to college for filmmaking. I went and did my master's degree in musical theater writing, and then after that, I found opera. I did the American Lyric Theater Composer Librettist Development Program, which gave me my first foray into the world of making opera. And there I met my first collaborator, and through that I met a second collaborator, and then from that collaborator I met Missy at Carnegie Hall.
Well, life changed.
My life changed.
That's so wonderful to hear. And what I love about your story is those people in your life, those two teachers and your family who gave you a confidence to try things out.
Absolutely.
And to have that agency. And that's quite rare, I think, sometimes. You don't always find that with that, you know, people really offering you. Your whole drama department budget was allocated to you. That's very special, actually,
yeah,
to have that, isn't it?
So, absolutely.
And I'm sure that's given you a huge boost in order to have the confidence to forge on through in your wonderful career. So.
Yeah, but also really put an emphasis on the storytelling.
Yeah.
Like, maybe we didn't have thousands of dollars that the volleyball team had, but if you really thought of really extraordinary stories and were able to tell them in a dynamic way, that's the magic of theater, right? Like, you just give me a black box and a great story, and we can make magic happen. We can transport you to a totally different world. And so it was the greatest education just in that.
Mm, I love that. That's beautiful. So you said you met. So tell me how you met. How did this collaboration start?
We met in the lobby of Carnegie Hall in New York, which is a great story and totally unexpected. Royce had been working with a colleague of mine, David T. Little, amazing composer, who on their opera Dog Days, and they presented excerpts of it at Carnegie Hall that night. And I saw these excerpts and I said, who wrote this text? I mean, there was cursing in it. There were, teenagers drinking beer in this opera. It was just like, I've never seen an opera that did that. And so I went up to Royce, after the show and I, said, I really enjoyed your piece. And can I give you a flyer for a show that I'm doing? And I was presenting excerpts of what would become our first opera, actually. So I'd started writing the libretto myself because I didn't know any librettists. I was going to present excerpts and an attempt to get other, presenters and people interested. And so he came to the show. He loved it. I hope. and I then met with him and asked him to help me finish it, to help me make it a full evening length work. And that became our first opera, Song from the Uproar, which has gone all over it and will have its UK premiere in February in a concert version with the BBC Singers.
How wonderful.
It's an older work for us, you know, in that it premiered 11 years ago, but we still really stand by it. And it was the beginning of what became a really fruitful collaboration.
Yeah. And when you're working out that collaborative journey together, that must have been hugely exciting, because I can tell just the way you work. You bounce ideas, you share things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me to be a true collaboration in a way.
Every way, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that the weird thing or the unusual thing about us is that we're also best friends. So we spend Christmases together. We go on vacations together. You know, we're in each other's lives all the time. We live about a mile away from each other in Brooklyn. I can walk over to Royce's house. You know, we just, our lives are very much entwined as friends, as well as professional collaborators. So we'll be in a cab, you know, going to get drinks in New York and just like say, oh, but that moment in the show I was thinking about, we should have this weird chorus of pigs there or something.
Wonderful.
You know, and so it's a constant dialogue about the work, and there's a freedom there. I can say, oh, this line isn't working for me, you know, and it doesn't, Royce isn't offended by that. And likewise, he can say, I think the music needs to do this, or I think we need to approach this person, or we need to do this project. And there's no offense taken. Like, we're not precious about the work because we're making it together.
Yeah. And that's true trust, actually. I can really mm-hmm. see a trusting relationship, which must be, you know, so helpful for the collaborative process. Mm-hmm. And how would you describe it from your side, Royce, about how you collaborate together?
Yeah, everything that Missy said. And I think that it's important to have somebody who sort of keeps you in check. And especially when you're deciding what stories you want to tell, because opera takes so long, often it takes 3 to a gazillion years to make an opera come to fruition. It is a really humongous investment of time and energy. And so we spend a lot of time just talking about what stories we need to invest that time and real estate of our lives into. And so, yeah, I think that Missy is the perfect person. And we have such amazing art, the Venn diagrams, really, our interests are that we have a large, is it centric, concentric circle?
Overlap.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
We're not.
You work in the same
circle. We're not that.
No, we're talking about that.
I love that. Well, that's wonderful. I can really feel that collaboration here. So it will be great to hear, Missy, what you've been working on this week in Studio 2. Yeah.
So we have been working with the amazing director, Tom Morris. The three of us have holed ourselves up in Studio 2. And it's really interesting that it's a former stable, because we are creating an opera called The Galloping Cure that has as its central image horses. This is a work that we have a fourth collaborator, the writer Karen Russell. And the way that this project started was we asked Karen to create a sort of draft, a very rough sort of treatment of a story about that would combine the Kafka story, A Country Doctor, with an invented tale set in the opioid crisis that's happening. This story is set in America, but this is a crisis that's happening all over the world. It has resonance, and just the very idea of writing a piece about addiction has resonance that goes beyond the current opioid crisis. So, Royce, do you want to take it from here with the story? I think you're better at explaining the story.
Sure. The story is about a doctor who is living in rural Pennsylvania, who lives in a town that is riddled by pain. And a strange man comes to town and erects a carousel. And the people of the town start to utilize this carousel, and it alleviates their pain to such a magnificent degree that it becomes addictive. This cure to their pain becomes addictive. And then the doctor's own daughter becomes completely enveloped by this carousel and these weird horses, stick horses, that become sort of the fractured version of the carousel that they are able to take into their own homes and use as their as the cure to their ailments. And then that's sort of the happy part of the story.
Wow.
Then things decline.
Yeah. Great. Okay. And so how do you think this will have resonance, or how do you hope it to influence your audience in a way? What sort of questions do you think are central to the work that you've been creating?
What a great question. I want the audience to come, and because we are framing this as a fairy tale, I think that there are many different levels that you can enjoy, maybe the wrong word, because it is a pretty harrowing story. But I do think that I hope that people see the direct connection to what is going on in relation to the opioid crisis around the world. But I also hope that the story has resonance and will have resonance in 100 years when there are new things that we find our culture is addicted to, or new treatments that are a little suspect, or that there are new things that the world is contending with. I think that it really does feel like it is directly reflecting on and rendering a problem that is so,
prevalent.
Prevalent is a good word.
Prevalent and current in today's society.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that as artists, we are meant to put a mirror up to our own experience. But what's funny is the cycle of that. I'm sure that there might be connections to really biblical stories of that and things like that, or things that have happened 1,000 years ago. And I hope that this, I hope that this has resonance in 100 years is also wrong, because I really hope that we figure out this crisis and that. But knowing humanity and knowing human nature. I think that this is something that we will be struggling with as long as humans draw breath on the planet.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. And I think it gives the opportunity for the audience being faced with situations like this to have some critical reflection time and critical thinking themselves in response to pieces that are put out. I think that the power of the arts to change hearts and minds, or to allow people to approach these big problems in a different way and to think about them, is so... so important, really. So, really, really interesting.
I think I would also add that I think that, you know, our goal with, I think, all of our work is that we're comfortable leaving the audience with more questions than they have answers. Mm-hmm. So if the message of this piece is, you know, don't do drugs, or we really need to figure out this opioid problem, that's not interesting, because I could just say that to you and then that's the message. I think that the ending of this piece is ambiguous, and it questions, you know, leaves you with the question of what does it mean to be alive in the midst of a worldwide crisis, and what personal decisions do you make to go on with your life? What does it mean to keep on living in the midst of that? We don't have any illusions that this is going to change things. But I think, as you said, that was beautiful. It's like it gives people a chance for personal reflection in a different way. It hopefully gives voice to feelings that they have not yet had words for, that the music and the drama, the set, the combination of everything we're making will illuminate that for them. But I also think it's interesting that this Kafka story, that is sort of the backbone of our piece, one of the central themes is the inability of the arts to change things. And so the story is of a doctor who goes on a house call and is unable to help a patient, and he's just frustrated. And that's often used as a mirror for Kafka's own experience, that he's writing these stories that he has the goal in the back of his mind of changing society, and then this frustration of realizing that his power is limited. But what he can do is hold up a mirror and provide that space for reflection and thought and connection between people, that we all feel this powerlessness, and there's power in that.
That's absolutely beautiful. I love hearing you talk about those sort of connections and reflections. And from your point of view as a composer, how do you then take this huge story actually and actually start writing? I'm fascinated about the process of how do you actually start the music.
Well, it's been interesting being here. Like, there's something about being here at Hawkwood, being in a beautiful setting, being with trusted collaborators and amongst very nice people, that has made me feel very free. So I've actually started writing music even this week, just based on, you know, lyrics that Royce has created the result of our brainstorms. And honestly, I feel like you just have to start writing an aria or a song. It's kind of like whatever idea comes up, you just take a look at it, you know? So I've been improvising on the piano. Something catches my ear, I'll just look at it. I'll play it over and over and try to see the potential in that idea. But you can't think, it's almost like you can't think too hard about it at the beginning. You have to just be open to any idea coming in. Yeah. So that's been, this week has been very fun. And maybe I'm sure some of those ideas will find their way into the final work. But in general, you know, I usually start with a complete libretto. So Royce will write the complete text, and then I will often just start at the beginning. And it's coming up with ideas for the big moments in the piece and then kind of fill in the little dialogue in between as we go along.
Ah, fascinating. I'm always so interested to hear actually the process that artists go through. And it is a discipline as well, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Incredible discipline to be able to have this wonderful libretto, you know, libretto that you've created, and then you know, create this extraordinary music. So I think when we met the other night, I asked you the question, what starts first, the words or the music? Mm-hmm. And you were very clear that the words are there and then the music comes in and enlivens the whole story. Wonderful. So, Royce, I'm interested to hear, what are some of the challenges you found in your career and how have you overcome them?
It's impossible, almost, to be an artist in the 21st century. And so I think that we are very lucky to be at this point of our careers where we have agency to tell the stories that we want to tell and that we need to tell. But it is really, really tricky to put all the puzzle pieces together as a freelance artist and to the financial side of things, the time that each project takes, making sure that all of your collaborators are taken care of, whether they're composers or directors or designers or solo violinists that mm-hmm. you're writing concerti for, or a pianist that you're working with, or it's a huge community, and it's all about making sure that everybody is heard and that you give that agency to your collaborators. And so it's really about the balance of and the healthiness of your career and keeping your brain sort of kicking and alive and inspired but really I think it's about like the scheduling. That's the biggest the biggest thing is the scheduling, the money, making sure your bills are paid. It still is a challenge, and it will forever be a challenge
because the opportunities come along, right? And then you're working on another project, so how do you scheduling the time for that opportunity mm-hmm. to make sure that you hold it well while carrying on the other work. I can only imagine. Yeah, it's very interesting to hear.
And over breakfast, we were also talking about how sometimes it just takes forever for contracts to be figured out. So you'll have a piece that you are wanting to write, and then 3 years later, you will have the contract signed. And so how do you hold time for these things that you really want to do and that you're, it's not only the financial side of our lives, it's the financial side of all of these institutions. And now we are contending with the performing arts just sort of really being a bit crippled right now around the world. It seems that Broadway isn't back up to its 100%, and opera isn't in America. We're really struggling to get back on our feet after COVID. So that's a whole new thing, that the performing arts are really struggling to find institutional completeness in order to give us the opportunities to make our work. So it's the trickle down effect.
Yeah. I think there does seem to be a general feeling of uncertainty.
Absolutely.
And complexity at the moment mm-hmm. as we navigate our way out of this time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a lot to hold. So Missy, looking ahead, what excites you the most about your future opportunities, whether it's music or personally, what are you looking forward to? And I've got two questions here. Do you have a creative project that you've been dreaming about that hasn't yet been commissioned?
Well, I'm just looking forward to all of the big theatrical work that will come into the world in the next couple of years. We have a big opera that we wrote about a cult called The Listeners that will come to, that will premiere in America in about a year. And
whereabouts is that being premiered?
In Opera Philadelphia, and then Lyric Opera of Chicago, and also a performance in Essen in Germany. And so, and then of course, this piece will premiere in 2026, and we're writing a big piece at the same time for the Metropolitan Opera that will premiere there in 2026. So over the next couple of years, there's a lot of big theatrical work that will finally, that I can finally share with the world. And that is a really important moment for me to go from the isolation of composing and to having all these characters living, you know, rent free in my head, to sharing them with the world. All of a sudden, other people are humming these tunes. Other people are thinking about these stories, and it's like bringing your internal dialogue out into the open, after years of just ruminating on it musically. So I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, I always, I struggle with the question of like, oh, what is the project you're dying to do? Because I feel really lucky in that, like, this project we're writing now, The Galloping Cure, that I'm doing with Royce and Tom, is, and I should also say Opera Ventures, John Barry's production company, who has come along and made all this possible. That is my dream project for right now. And I just want to keep upping the stakes of the work and the scale of the work. And I know that along the way, there'll be a lot of other smaller scale works, but I always want to have my eyes on some massive theatrical production, because that's where I find that I'm at home.
Wonderful. Brilliant. Mm-hmm. Well, we look forward to seeing all those premieres coming up. That's amazing. What's the name of the piece you're doing for the Met?
So that is called Lincoln in the Bardo, and it's an adaptation of the George Saunders novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, which won the Booker Prize, I think, about 5 years ago. And we've been working actually with George, on that too, which has been great.
Fantastic. Great. Thank you. So Royce, when we met the other night, you talked about an exquisite story for children that you wanted to bring to life.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. So tell us about
that. Oh my goodness. One of the stories that I've just been completely obsessed with for the last decade or so, is Sylvia Waugh's The Menoms. And if anybody out there is listening and wants to commission a great opera for families, it's a beautiful, beautiful story about a family of rag dolls that lives in an attic whose lives are thrown into tumult when the landlord that they've been living in his home for many, 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 many years passes away, and one of his nephews comes to meet them because he's been told that they are the most wonderful tenants. But they are hidden, and they've been living a life as these hidden rag dolls. When I read it so many years ago, it completely boggled me and just set my imagination ablaze. And so I've been holding on to that as a story that I would love to tell at some point, and have no idea where that might go or who might help me tell it. But again, if anybody is listening.
I love that. That's wonderful. Let's see what we can make happen.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You're very welcome to come back and write that here. So I'm really interested, finally, where are you off to next after Hawkwood?
I'm going to London for 3 days of vacation.
Yay!
And to see friends, and then going home to New York. I find that I have a really hard time writing on the road. I mean, Hawkwood is the exception, but, you know, when I'm traveling, I have my keyboard, I have it in a hotel, but it's really hard for me to find that sustained creative time. So I'm just looking forward to being back in my own bed, in my own studio.
Wonderful. And Royce, where are you off to?
I'm off to Cambodia.
Cambodia.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to do a research trip with a Canadian composer named Vivian Fung, and we are writing an opera about her family's PTSD associated with fleeing Cambodia and going through Paris, I believe. Some of her family landed in Paris, and then some of them landed in Alberta, Canada. And she's been wanting to reflect on her family's experience, but it's been hard for them to open up. And so I believe that through this opera, they have been really willing, and it's opened up an opportunity for them to reveal their feelings about this. And we're going to dramatize their family history through this operatic adventure. We've written two songs that were commissioned by Edmonton Opera in Canada, not the Edmonton in the UK. And now we are expanding it to be a full evening length's work. And I'm not exactly sure what the form is going to be or how large it's going to be. I think it's just for two singers. The original presentation that we did was for a soprano and percussion, and that was it. And so I'm not sure if Vivian's going to want to expand that or if we're going to keep our forces rather small, but we're going to go and have 3 weeks where we experience the landscape and the history and the culture of Cambodia.
So important. Mm-hmm. These stories of migration are going to become more prevalent as we see challenges, I think, in society, in the world, that we're beginning to see at the moment. And we have another artist here that is actually based at Hawkwood called Shomik Datta, who has written a whole song piece around migration and stories of migration and beautiful. What that means. So I'd love to introduce you
absolutely.
To Shomik
please
at some
do.
Point.
Please
so we
do.
Must keep the mm-hmm. Hawkwood network going. Well, listen, I'd like to say a huge thank you to you both. It's been such a pleasure to have you at Hawkwood this week, and I do hope we can persuade you to come back and write some more opera here.
You will not have to twist our arms at all. My goodness,
anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
The That's pleasure wonderful. Was all ours.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, tell your friends, sign up to our mailing list, or on social media.